America is the pillar that holds up freedom. If that is the last one to fall, it'll collapse everywhere. I mean, it's just, and unfortunately, this is one of them. I mean, the internet is so widespread and so vast that if free speech dies, we're going to lose the world.
I am a husband, a father, a lawyer, a Christian, and a proud Canadian. I started this series because it was clear that our nation needs truth. Not just another biased narrative, but real information of substance. We need access to facts and the freedom to think for ourselves. I'm Leighton Gray, and this is Gray Matter.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Gray Matter. Well, unless you've been hiding in your basement since COVID broke out, or you've been on one of Elon Musk's rocket ship to Mars, you know that freedom of expression and freedom of speech is under attack worldwide. This is happening in Canada, and really the forefront of it, the epicenter of it, is going on in the United States. And our guest today is a man who is literally on the front lines of this, and he's going to talk about some very important legal challenges that he's leading, that he's spearheading, that are going all the way to the United States Supreme Court, and which will have impacts worldwide upon the way that governments deal with social media and to the extent to which they're going to be able to suppress and censor our speech online. His name is Jason Fick. Thanks for being with us today, Jason. I've been really looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you for having me, Leighton.
So before we introduce you properly, and you've got quite a fascinating history, we've got a few framing aphorisms that we're going to start off with. The first one is from Winston Churchill, who's very, very quotable, who said, "Everyone is in favor of free speech. Hardly a day passes without its being extolled. But some people's idea of it is that they are free to say what they like. But if anyone else says anything back, that is an outrage." The second is from a titan of American constitutional history, John Adams, who once wrote that the jaws of power are always open to devour, and her arm is always stretched out, if possible, to destroy the freedom of thinking, speaking, and writing. Those were prophetic and prescient words. Next, from the first American president, George Washington, whose birthday was recently celebrated, who said, "If freedom of speech is taken away, then dumb and silent we may be led like sheep to the slaughter." And finally, from the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who said that the court forgets that ours is a government of laws and not of men. That means we are governed by the terms of our laws and not by the enacted will of our lawmakers. In other words, rule of law, not rule by law. And this is gets at the heart of what we're going to be talking about today. So who do we have on the show? Well, Jason Fick, very fascinating biography. In 2010, Jason ventured into the business world of social media. Realizing the advertising potential of the platform, he created a series of popular pages on Facebook, which regularly published content related to pop culture and comedy. And this is very ingenious. He's really at the forefront of the use of social media. He had an incredible success. At the height of his success, actually, he held over 38 million followers and brought in over $300,000 per month from brand partnerships and advertising. But overnight, in October of 2016, Facebook just pulled the plug, taking 14 million fans away by unpublishing six of his pages. And Jason was told that Facebook would not restore them. So a few months later, he found out, he reached out to a former colleague in the social media advertising space to see if Facebook would restore the pages if another competitor became the owner. Ultimately, Facebook agreed to restore the pages at the request of Fick's competitor, but only if Fick was no longer the owner of the pages. So he sought out an attorney to represent him. And this was when he met Jeff Graber. Graber recognized Facebook's egregious anti-competitive misconduct and immediately agreed to take on Fick's case against Facebook, which is going on as we speak. So, Jason, welcome to the program. I want to say, as I mentioned off the top of the show, this concept of censorship through social media and government interference, government sort of weaponization of it, is a very serious problem worldwide. But you're one who was very early to the party, weren't you? Because of that history we just described.
Yeah, we because I started back in 2010 and got very, you know, very big very quickly. I mean, we were at one point larger than BuzzFeed. Wow. I understood.
You were like a pioneer. You really weren't.
We were out there. I mean, we were huge. And see, what most people didn't recognize at the time, and I recognized it right away, is Facebook specifically started implementing, you know, a paid for reach distribution program, right? They said, right, hey, look, pay us and we'll help prioritize and recommend your stuff. The problem is that actually directly competes with our content, right? Unlike normal sites where you see a banner ad on the side or on the top, that's not competitive. But when you're displacing organic content, so they're representing that it's free to use, except if they want you gone, they just make you disappear. Well, see, that's exactly what they did to me, is they went, whoa, wait, we need the space back because we need, you know, people to see our content, meaning the content that they're paid to show. So they got rid of me. And that's exactly what they did. They wiped me out. And the point was that the motive behind the design of their platform is to develop certain content over others, right? I mean, arguably they've said it outright. They said, well, we like this content, so we're going to support that content, and we don't like that content, so we're not going to support that content. Well, most people don't realize that's content provision. That's the same as being a publisher on any other site. The only thing that they're doing is they're laundering their own content provision through the creation by a third party. And see, the problem is courts haven't caught on yet that that's what that is. They're saying, well, we're just a neutral public forum. We're just neutrally, you know, restricting content. Well, they're not neutrally restricting content. There's intent, right? Mm-hmm. Like for example, aiding and abetting. Aiding and abetting really comes down to the intent, doesn't it? Because you're not aiding and abetting if you don't know. So if they're just taking down content because it's potentially harmful, no problem. But what if their intent is that they want to develop one idea over another? Well, now all of a sudden they control. See, they're not just restricting speech. They're actually controlling whose speech is amplified. That becomes problematic because they can then control the narrative. So that's what we sort of caught on to early on. And while a lot of people say, well, your whole case is about financials, right? Money. It is, because courts understand money. But if they can be discriminatory about money, they can be discriminatory about COVID-19, shots. Yeah. They can be discriminatory about transgenderism. They can pick a narrative that they want, and they're not just restricting in good faith. Mm-hmm. They're actually restricting based on what they want to develop. That's a whole different concept.
You know, Jason, just to follow up on that point, I'm curious to know, when you first hired your lawyer and you got into this, now obviously you're massively screwed over millions of dollars, right?
Oh yeah.
Which must have been a really bad day. But it seems to me, am I right in understanding that initially it was sort of a commercial dispute, right? Mm-hmm. Using legal terms. But then as you and your lawyer got into it, you started to discover many, many more layers that you just described, and what Facebook was really into, what's these social media companies are really doing. And that is controlling what has become the new public square. The modern public square is online and the social media. So were you aware to the extent to which social media companies like Facebook were doing this at the time that you decided to sue them, or was it a more started out as a commercial dispute and then kind of grew into something deeper?
Well, I think that's the point, is it was originally a commercial dispute, right? Because what they did was they designed their algorithm and their platform to be anti-competitive until they became the Leviathans that we deal with today, right? They got huge. Yeah. How did they get huge? They basically stole everything from everybody. They stole everybody's distribution to give it to someone else anti-competitively. Well, once they got gigantic, all of a sudden they didn't need anybody anymore, right? So what they did was they turned that same discriminatory filtration, right? And that's the point. It's not neutral. There's an intent there to develop certain contents. So the point was that turned into ideology, politics, and everything else. So it's the same process, but it evolved. Now, the thing that I would say that I caught on earlier than most but is become more problematic than anything is that the government itself has actually been influencing these companies, right?
Right.
And when I say influencing,
is this what the Section 230 fight is all about?
Well, see, they're two different things. Section 230 is essentially a liability immunity, right? It's an affirmative defense.
Okay.
And this is something that nobody talks about because nobody even understands what type of law it is. So it's an administrative law that gives regulatory control to be able to regulate information voluntarily. It says one private entity can regulate the speech of another private entity. Okay. And they say, well, we have a First Amendment right to do so. Sure. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't immunize you from liability. That's different. So this immunizes them from liability. But in that circumstance, like I said, it's an affirmative defense. Well, let's take an affirmative defense that your audience will understand. Self-defense. If you shoot somebody, right, you're committing an otherwise unlawful act. It's homicide. Sure. But if a certain set of circumstances can be proven that you were acting to defend your life or someone else's life, right, meaning the burden of proof is shifting to the defendant, if they prove that they acted within the confines of the law, they're granted an affirmative defense to be protected, meaning they're not going to go to jail. They don't just walk away. They don't just say, hey, yeah, cool. I shot him in self-defense. No, you go to trial. You go before a peer of your, you know, a jury of your peers, and they decide based on the facts and the evidence. Well, here, they're supposed, this is the way Section 230 should work. The point is that if they restrain your materials, content, information, whatever, they're supposed to be doing it in good faith. That's what the law says.
Right.
And that good faith, everybody says, well, they're not doing it. Well, that's because judges aren't supposed to be making that decision. It's actually supposed to be a jury. So you're actually supposed to get through discovery to get to trial to see, because that is the only way it would be not unconstitutional, because the government wouldn't be making that decision. A jury of your peers would be making that decision, whether it was good faith or not. But see, that's actually, now everybody thinks that's the problem with this law, Section 230.
Right.
It's not. The problem has been hiding. So the point that we have been arguing for years, and it wasn't until recently a case called, and I would implore any lawyer that was watching this, go read Dangard versus Instagram, right? It's a Northern District of California decision. Judge Alsup, very senior judge, he nailed it. And when I say nailed it, this is the holy grail of Section 230 cases that no one knows about. The reason
are you surprised that decision came out of California?
I'm very surprised. It's in the same court that has denied me. And we're sitting there saying, why are you not paying attention to your own court judges? I mean, it is, when I say identical to my case, you could literally substitute names. That's it.
Really?
It's identical. Wow. But yet they got justice and I didn't get justice. I was actually denied on my due process. Now, here's what the actual mistake was. The courts read the law wrong, right? You know how the law is important. You had to follow it by the letter of the law, right? Well, and it's funny because you started with the presidents. Well, I'll give you something interesting. James Madison, right? He once argued in the Federalist that the most important word in the right to free speech is the word the.
Really?
Yeah, because it denotes that the right already existed. We already knew about it, right? Because the word the is what's called a definite article. We know.
Sure.
But I'll give you an example. A White House or the White House.
Oh, yeah.
See the difference? Brilliant. You don't even have to have the rest of the context because we know what the White House is. So the point was, is that the way the law is written, it says no provider, user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. So if we know who the publisher or speaker is, who is it? It's another information content provider, correct? It's a who.
Yeah.
It's who. It's real simple. They didn't read it that way. Because of sloppy draftsmanship over 2.5 decades, it went from the publisher speaker to a publisher or speaker. It went indefinite. So we don't know who it is. So now if you change that sentence, the who becomes a what. All of a sudden, they can't be treated as a publisher in the general sense. Well, if they are a publisher, a secondary publisher, now they can't be treated as themselves. All of a sudden, it became super immunity. That was a mistake, a flaw in the actual grammar, that they made a mistake in the law that has essentially infected cases. So some cases get it right because they read it right. Some cases get it wrong because they read it wrong. They read it wrong in my case. And we've been arguing it back and forth. But see, the thing is that if you can't treat them as a publisher, wouldn't restricting materials be a publication decision? Restricting content.
Obviously you're editing. Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
Now, if you can't be treated as a publisher when you're acting as one, the second law becomes redundant. You don't need it. And see, Judge Alsup finally said it. He finally said that in that case, which is exactly what happened in my case, he said that Facebook could have brought a 230C2 defense, which is the Good Samaritan one, but instead brought a C1 defense and said we can't be treated as a publisher. And he said to accept that decision would make 230C1 a backdoor to CDA immunity, meaning it would circumvent the evidentiary requirements of C2, meaning we never go to court over the Good Samaritan thing because they just said we can't be treated as a publisher. Yes, you can. You can only not be treated as the publisher. So it's a matter of the law has degraded to the point that courts just aren't reading stuff properly. And we've been saying it, but it wasn't until this judge came along and said, hey, that's right. And now we're back in the Ninth Circuit now, right? Because we have district court and people know, and then from there you go to appellate court, and then from there you go to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Well, we have – go ahead.
Just want to clarify something. So because social media, let's use Facebook as an example, is not considered in law a publisher, then they are effectively exempted from being liable for violations of constitutional freedoms, such as freedom of expression. Is that – am I orbiting the right planet here?
So the point is that they can't be a publisher. They can't be treated as a publisher.
Right.
But they can be a publisher. Right. That means that they can do anything to us. They can pick and choose what content we see. That's publishing, right? That's standard editorial decisions, except that's not the way the law is supposed to be applied. That would be super immunity. It's sovereignty. What that means is, now see, this is where people get a little confused, and I'm going to try and sort of make you understand this a little better.
Sure.
A private entity can restrain, because all the trolls out there say, oh, and they fight our First Amendment arguments. Should Facebook not have a First Amendment argument? Absolutely. They can act as a publisher if they want, but they're not exempt from liability from it. Meaning, and I'll give you a good example. We could say, let's pick something horrible. I don't like black people, right? That's not actually me. I'm just saying that's a horrible statement, right?
Yeah. Kendi can say the opposite with impunity, but that's another discussion.
I can say it. It's a First Amendment right. The government can't compel me to change that, can they? I can say it, but what if I said it in the context of firing somebody? I hate black people, so you're fired.
Yeah.
It's not about a First Amendment right anymore. Yeah, sure, you have a right to say it. Government can't impede that, but you broke a law. And that's what the people don't understand. There's the difference between, Facebook has a right to act and make decisions and whatever, but it doesn't mean that that's immune from liability under Section 230. Section 230 is only if they're a neutral forum, meaning they actually have to act within the confines of the Constitution. Why? Yeah. Think of it this way. If somebody shoots somebody, right, they would go to jail. But if they invoke the state's affirmative defense, self-defense, they're saying that they acted within the confines of the law, correct?
Right.
Okay. Yes. So if Facebook is invoking, or any of the big tech invokes, the affirmative defense of Section 230, they're saying they acted within the confines of the law, and that law has to follow the Constitution. Meaning, the judge in that circumstance is actually tasked. He has what's called an affirmative duty. Right, because there's a special relationship between the private entity and the government because of this statute. They have an affirmative duty to be critical and say, did you act properly when you restrained the individual civil liberties of the third party? They're actually supposed to be our advocates. They haven't done that, clearly, right? Nobody's had an advocate from court. No, but the judges are literally supposed to be our advocates, and they're just not.
What about the relationship between social media and government? And we really saw this come to the fore during COVID when, for example, certain people like, Dr. McCullough, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya and others were castigated by Dr. Fauci and had things that they said online, which we turned out to be quite true and would have been beneficial to public health, had their comments suppressed or removed. What about this relationship, what seemingly cozy relationship between government and social media? How does that tie into this whole picture?
So you just poked a bee's head.
Sorry.
It's like, okay, here we go. So this is something where, and I'm going to give you the overview this time around, but I think that we're probably going to be back for a much more in-depth conversation because this is love a whole different thing that most people have no idea. But so let me just preface this by saying that I am not a bar license attorney, but you don't have to be a bar license attorney to understand the law, right? I just had to learn by necessity, and I have.
Like what Abraham Lincoln did.
Exactly. They didn't have a bar license back then, right?
Turned out to be a pretty smart guy.
Exactly. That's all it is. It's just understanding like how it all interacts. Now, so the point I say that is because currently I work as an expert consultant with my attorneys on other people's lawsuits. We handle other people's suits, yes. And we have one that is coming out very soon, probably within the next 2 to 3 weeks. That is a bombshell. Absolute bombshell. Now, the reason I say that is because we've made the connections. We know exactly what they're doing. So this is the interactions, and I'm going to try to just give you a quick overview. So what we have found out is the Department of Defense, the Department of State, and the Department of Homeland Security has been funding private corporations like NewsGuard, right? Our government has been giving money to create censorship tools. Now, the censorship tools were supposed to be originally aimed at foreign countries, except they turned them inward. They turned them domestic. And then what they did is companies like NewsGuard, and I'll give you another one. They offshored one called the ISD, which is the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. And they're also involved with something called the Strong Cities Network, which nobody's heard about. We got into it. We know this actually already, this started all the way back with Obama. And it was introduced originally from HUD. Not
surprisingly.
I mean, it goes way back, all the way back to 2006. Mm-hmm. Now, what happens is that all of these censorship tools that were created with government money, they then invited big tech companies to come in and use their blacklist. Now, in the case of NewsGuard, it was a red list. It was like a stoplight, red, green, yellow. Now, the thing is that, so we've had government money actually set up and pay for the censorship tools that these companies are making. And they're putting them on lists, and they've even offshore them, like Institute for Strategic.
Are we talking like millions, tens of millions, hundreds
millions,
of millions?
Millions.
Wow.
That's only what we know. I mean, we're talking about money that it's on record. We know where it went, and we know that those companies are also working with these big tech companies. Now the point is that they've created these lists through government money, and then the companies are acting. And the reason they say, well, we didn't instruct them, we didn't tell them what to do, we gave them a list. And they did it, of course, because they're also getting protected by the same company. And the point of to give you an idea, you understand what extortion is, right?
Oh, of course.
Extortion.
Yeah, trying to get somebody from somebody else through the use of force or violence. Yeah.
So essentially, like the mob used to come in and they say, well, it'd be a shame if your business burnt down. You should pay for protection.
It's a really
right?
nice story you have here. Yeah.
Right. It's a protection racket. Well, the point is that it's the absence of harm coming from the same party that's granting you the protection. That's how an extortion scheme works.
Yeah.
Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Well, if you don't do what we say as the government, it'd be a shame if you lost your protections.
So that's the relationship between government and social media, you're saying?
They're basically, they're holding it over their heads just the same as, I mean, think about it this way. When you pay for advertising on Facebook or Google or anything else like that, right? You're paying their extortion fee to maintain your distribution, because if you don't pay it, be a shame if you got banned. It's the same extortion scheme. It's just, it's just trickle down effect. And the point there is that if government money is funding these private entities and those private entities are working with other private entities, the ones that we have a direct connection from the government straight down. Sorry, government funded censorship. And we're going to see how it goes. Now, that's very much like the Missouri versus Biden case. You know, that's a direct, right. They're going after the Biden administration because the Biden administration was in fact doing this. So yes, there is a correlation. And I'll give you one more good one. I love this one. Everybody says, well, they're not government entities. No, they're not government entities in the sense that they're not employees of the government, and they really can't qualify them as an agency, but they're acting like an agency, right? Facebook's almost like an
agency. They're state actors. Yeah. Yeah. Gotcha.
Well, let me give you the actual definition. They're not necessarily state actors. They are private government instrumentalities. Okay. They are the instrument of the government censorship. And the reason being is because there is a statute, a mandate with a government instruction. It says to block and screen offensive materials. So effectively, when that private entity invokes the affirmative defense, they're saying, I did what the government said to do. That's an admission. As soon as they're, and that's exactly why there's an affirmative duty, because if the government's giving them a job and then granting them protection to do that job in an administrative capacity as an instrument of government, they have to be sure that our rights are protected, and they haven't done that. That's the point. So there's a lot of things about this law that I guarantee you, anybody that says, oh, I understand Section 230. Yeah. Show them this conversation and they'll be like, because this is not things that people were talking about because they don't understand this law incredibly well.
Right. And this case has been going on for a while now. And I correct and understand that Mr. Zuckerberg has actually had to testify at some point already in the case?
No. See, this is the problem that we have. The courts basically said that I was treating them as a publisher. It's irrelevant. My content's irrelevant. The point of what we were saying is that the entire design of their platform, everything that they did was anti-competitive, right? The motive was wrong. And at the threshold, they're supposed to be a good Samaritan. It says that. It says good Samaritan protections. Yeah. Well, if they're not a good Samaritan and anti-competitive animus is antithetical to being a good Samaritan, they should fail instantly on any kind of immunity.
Yeah.
But the court
seems to me they were the opposite of a good Samaritan to you and your company. You're going along brilliantly, making all this money, and instead of finding you on the roadside and helping you, they basically put a bullet in your brain, you know, business-wise.
Yeah. They had,
so it seems like it's the opposite.
It had nothing to do with my content's impropriety at all. And I can prove that 100%. But the point was, is that I mentioned content. They went, oh, it's a publishing decision. Well, just because a publishing decision occurred doesn't mean that the entire motive is wrong. And see, remember what I said about C1 being a backdoor to C2? That's exactly what they did to me. They used C1 as a backdoor. There was no C2 ever applied. So it didn't matter that didn't act in good faith. But see, they made a mistake. Courts... they did a big one, and this one's where we caught them. We essentially said, well, they're not a good Samaritan. And then the court said, well, good Samaritan doesn't apply to C1, right? Essentially what they just said there is that 230C's good Samaritan doesn't apply to C1. It skips it and goes to C2. In other words, the general provision doesn't apply generally. Well, that's odd, right? It's just selective. Right, that's not how laws work. But see, there's a problem with that.
Selective is another word for discriminatory.
Exactly. There's a bigger problem with that constitutional issue now. So, with the constitutional issue is, have you ever heard of the non-delegation doctrine?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So it says basically that Congress can't delegate regulatory authority, which is exactly what Section 230 is, without an intelligible principle. You ever heard of that one? An intelligible principle?
Intelligible principle, yes.
That's what self-defense is.
Right.
It's the basic principle. You have to be acting in self-defense. Here you have to be a good Samaritan. They said that the intelligible principle doesn't apply to C1 and that they can do anything that they want to me, regulate me, restrain my individual civil liberties without an intelligible principle. That's unconstitutional.
Because they're not a publisher. Because
they can't be treated as a publisher.
Yeah.
They basically said... they can't be held accountable for their own conduct, and their conduct doesn't actually have to be within the intelligible principle, which is flat out a violation of my due process. It doesn't fit the non-delegation doctrine. So this is important because after 6 years of litigation, we have been to the Supreme Court twice. And unfortunately, our second petition that came to the Supreme Court would have fixed the entire internet. Everything. I can say it unequivocally that they had handled it. It would have been over. We would have fixed all the internet. The question is, do they want to fix the internet? Do they want to fix this problem, or are they just trying to avoid me because they know it will fix it? Mm-hmm. Well, see, now they've got a bit of a bind. We filed something called a Rule 5.1 constitutional challenge, right? And procedurally, it's not forfeitable. It says it right in there, a big section. Non-forfeiture. Why? Because it's a constitutional right. I've been denied of my due process. I have a right to challenge the law that denied me of my due process. Guess what the Northern District of California did? Terminated it. You. They forfeited it. And they can't forfeit it.
So let me guess. So now that case, you're going to go back to the Supreme Court. Now.
Well, see, now we have a constitutional challenge moving forward. It is now in the appellate court. And I mean, I don't know if the Ninth Circuit is done. I don't know what they're doing over there. But the reality is we've handed them something that is a constitutional deprivation of right. It happened. My due process was denied. I am challenging the law. The procedure that we use is not forfeitable. The lower court forfeited it. I'm absolutely 100% right because Dangar versus Instagram proves I'm right. Henderson versus Public Data in the Fourth Circuit proved. I got like six or seven cases proving we're right. And all we're asking is I want the same justice that everybody else gets, and I want you to fix this law because the way that you can't use C1 for any conduct at all. It just doesn't work. But now that constitutional challenge is working its way back to the Supreme Court, and we were talking before coming on air, there's three types of cases the Supreme Court handles. If the Ninth Circuit sends this through because they just don't want – I mean, if they're just bound and determined to deny me and my rights, I mean, there's just nothing I'm going to be able to do there. But the Supreme Court handles three types of cases. Habeas corpus when somebody's on death row because they're being denied of their rights. A constitutional challenge because they're being denied of their rights. And when you have circuit court conflicts because they're the last line, they've got to have a tiebreaker. Who's right? Is the Fourth Circuit right or is the Ninth Circuit right? I've got two out of the three. This is something the Supreme Court's just got to handle. Like, our third time, my rights are being denied here.
Well, this is being touted as the case to end big tech censorship.
It could.
So why do you think that's true? If let's say you go to the Supreme Court and you're successful, you get the decision that you and your lawyer consider to be proper. How is that going to effectively end big tech censorship?
It's good question. Okay, so here's the way it works. It lays out. 230C1's back door gets closed, right? 230C1 then becomes a very, very simple law. It says you can't be treated as someone else. Done. Makes sense, right? If you didn't do anything as a provider, and that doesn't include, we allowed content because you did something. You considered it and then allowed it to proceed. That's content development. That's not covered. It basically, it's just like a Good Samaritan. If you have nothing to do with an accident, you can't be treated as someone in the accident. C1 gets straightened out. Now, if someone brings a case that says, well, they didn't act in good faith as a Good Samaritan, the judges aren't throwing them out anymore because now it's a matter of, okay, now we go to discovery. We get the facts of the case. We take it to trial. Well, now they're subject to liability. And while the government can't compel them to host speech, right? That's the government can't stop the censorship because they're a private entity. Liability will. Because if they're restricting content in bad faith, now, does it mean that just because they take your content down that you can sue them? No, it doesn't. As a matter of fact, I think it should be a heavy burden to prove that it was in bad faith. Because if they just take it down because it's, I don't know, maybe it offended somebody. Okay, maybe. Mm-hmm. But if they're doing it with some sort of, because let's say they're taking it down because they're black. It's just straight outright discrimination, right? The point is, if they're breaking laws, it wouldn't be in good faith. A jury of your peers would then determine that. People would finally get to court. Well, guess what's going to happen if they're going, like, because courts, of course, companies have a fiduciary obligation to protect their investors, right?
Right.
Money will drive it. They'll go, whoa, we can't restrict everything because that would actually wipe us out because we'll get sued into the ground. Not only that, but think about it. now they can't decide who's the winners and who's the losers anymore, because if they're deciding who the winners are, advertisers in my case, right? Like other competitors, my straight line competitors worked as a group boycott to push me out. Well, they can't work in unison with the government anymore, because if they are, they're actually developing the idea that vaccines are good. They can't have an intent to develop anything anymore. They have to go neutral again. They have to literally be the neutral public square if I win. All of a sudden, the internet literally levels out, but they will not be the dominant control anymore. And that's why the government is terrified of this situation, because if I fix this, if the courts finally do this, which they should, I mean, how long do I have to have my rights denied? What they did to me was illegal. It's not covered by 230. The courts have misinterpreted this law. It needs to be a neutral public forum, period.
Yeah. So if you win, we're talking about really a massive award to you, like in the millions of dollars.
Billions. Think about it. I was larger than BuzzFeed, and my prospective economic advantage was wiped out very early on. 38 million people, when most people had like maybe 4,000 fans.
Yeah. So you have to factor in that growth, that anticipated growth.
Even if you just look at BuzzFeed as an analogous, I mean, I was working on an app that would have been worth billions, but no, you can't survive in the app world because they'll take you out of the app store. That has nothing to do with restricting offensive content, right? That has to do with anti-competitive animus. Parler should have sued the snot out of them, but they...
Well, that's a question I have for you, Jason, is how is it that these big tech companies are avoiding liability under antitrust legislation? How are they doing that? Is it just under the aegis of government that, you know, the government is just sort of looking the other way? Because it seems to me they've created essentially a cartel whereby they can wipe out people like you. As you say, if they had left you alone, you could have reached a level where you were a major competitor to them. And they just killed you before you could get there. Well, and you're probably not the only person that they're doing this to, right?
There's a couple.
So how are they avoiding the antitrust law in the U.S.?
So there's a couple factors. Okay, so antitrust on a Sherman level, you know, Sherman Act level, like federal level,
yeah,
it's tougher to prove. It's a much bigger situation. Unfair competition is the state level version. That's what we're suing over right now. Unfair competition, tortious interference, extortion, and fraud. And the reason they're getting away with it is because the C1 is being used as the back door. That back door needs to be shut.
Once that
happens, then all of a sudden they are actually going to be liable for that. But the problem with it is right at the moment is that, and I think that you should read tomorrow we'll be filing a Ninth Circuit appeal. Everybody should read that. It is addressing pretty much everything that is wrong with this situation. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that we have to deal with is that nobody can take this on. It is a Herculean task because the California courts have made it impassable. They don't want to deal with this, and yet 95% of the cases come through California, but they don't want these cases going to court. So they're effectively, actively, and affirmatively protecting these companies because, one, they don't have to deal with it then, and two, people say, well, they're in conclusion. I wouldn't necessarily say they're in collusion with one another, but the reality is that they have, it's a pill they're going to have to swallow, which is they've allowed these companies to become these completely illegal, you know, Leviathan companies. And the reality now is that, they're subject to liability. Is it going to be catastrophic for the big tech companies? Yep. Why? Because their entire business models are illegal. The whole thing.
Yeah.
Right? You know, Google, you search something, what do you see first? The things they're paid to show you, which displaces everybody else. It's anti-competitive. Mm-hmm. They're not allowed to do that.
It's catastrophic the other way too, though, isn't it? Because if you don't win, if this isn't taken apart, this isn't ameliorated, if it isn't fixed, then the result is going to be that the right to free speech on the internet is basically over.
Correct. Right? That is literally, people have no idea how important what I'm doing is. It's overlooked because it's too complicated.
Well, I do.
People.
That's why I had you on the show. But right. I'm starting to get the marble starting to drop even deeper as I listen.
On one side, we fix the internet. On the other side, we lose free speech on the internet. And if we lose free speech on the internet, we effectively lose everything globally.
Yeah. So Jason, I have to ask you this. Now, we know how these companies operate. We know how brutal they can be. So obviously you've lost countless sums of money because interruption with your business. But have you been targeted and attacked personally by these companies because you've taken on this legal fight against them?
I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm not sure I want to discuss it because, but I will say that there are circumstances that have exceeded just a court fight. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, I mean, you know, God bless you for taking this on because, you know, really you're a modern champion of free speech. Yes, there's a lot of money involved, but you know, it's pretty clear from listening to you that that's not why you're in this. That's not why you're doing this. You're doing this because you see that yourself as someone who's been put in a situation to right a very serious wrong that's going to impact literally billions and billions of people around the world. Because if this gets fixed in the United States, we know that you know what happens in that Silicon Valley that has reverberations for the entire world, right?
Right. America is the pillar that holds up freedom. If that is the last one to fall, it'll collapse everywhere. I mean, it's just and unfortunately, this is one of them. I mean, the internet is so widespread and so vast that if free speech dies, we're going to lose the world. I mean, it will be because everybody says, well, you know, what's so important about it? And I sit there and say, well, what if something really bad happened? And they say, well, yeah, we'll tell people. And I'm like, how? Big tech?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like raising money. Everybody says, well, that's great. How do you raise money? What, am I going to crowdsource on big tech? Like, it's not going to happen. We've had virtually no support. Matter of fact, if you don't mind, I mean, if your audience wants to help, I mean, this is legit the fight. This is not somebody campaigning to go out and whatever.
Yeah.
We actually use the money for this. Socialmediafreedom.org. Again, it's socialmediafreedom.org. It is a 501c3. That would be tremendous.
Speaking of toppling freedom, and I know that you know, you're probably not following closely the situation that's happening in Canada, but let me just give you I want to get your take on a couple of things that are happening in Canada that are sort of maybe manifestations of what's happening in the US. So in the past couple of years, the governor of Canada has passed certain censorship laws restricting the activities of social media online. And one of the bills that they passed last year, the effect of it was, and you can correct me if this is wrong, but the way it was explained to me is that the delivery of news, you just use this example, delivery of news over Facebook in Canada, and I expect the United States as well, was one of the main sources, perhaps the primary source for many people for how they got their news in Canada. What the governor of Canada did is they passed a law. And they told Facebook, which previously had sort of delivered, had sort of operated as a modern day paper boy, you know, delivering this free service, bringing news to people on their phones, on their tablets, on their laptops. Government of Canada said every time now we're gonna charge you for providing this free service to our population, and Facebook just said no, and now. And everyone in Canada lost access to the delivery of news via Facebook. So that's kind of a manifestation of what we're talking about. Would you agree?
Well, it's a great example of how money drives how these companies operate, right?
Yeah.
They basically, you know, your government, Canada, said, hey, we're going to charge you if you're going to bring news here. And they said, buy. And that's just it, is they have to look at the financials. And that's really the only way to push back against companies like this, right? Mm-hmm. The unfortunate part is that, you know, while we have Section 230 to deal with, which is Title 47 U.S. Code Section 230, there that doesn't apply to other countries, right? And and neither does our constitutional rights. Now, those constitutional rights, you know, in other countries, they can dictate whether or not these companies operate in those countries, right? Because I believe Facebook was trying to court China, right? And they wanted to see how they could control speech.
I think Google has at certain times too.
Right. And the point there is that how much can they control, right? Well, of course, that's the dangers of AI that's coming, because they'll be able to control it at scale, like very fast. Now, the problem that we face is that how do we get countries? And I mean, I mean, in a way, I'm kind of happy that Facebook said, nope, we won't do business in Canada, right? Mm-hmm. Because realistically, you know, what we talked about, you know, the very beginning of this is that it was your staff. We were talking about it, and he said, Canadians are just sort of like, yeah, okay, whatever. They don't really care, right? It's always been a country of just sort of being neutral, like, eh, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the more things you cut off, the more angry they're going to get. And eventually there will be a breaking point. And I think that the world is poised for that nationwide and globally. It's breaking. I mean, you see countries like France and so forth, and they're all revolting. Why? Because the global control that is clear now. And the reason being is because social media kind of got ahead and it got information out before they knew how to control it and censor it at scale. Now the cat's out of the bag and people are like, well, wait, we are being censored. And wait, they are taking stuff from us and they are taking our human rights. I mean, forget constitutional rights. How about our human rights? They're taking them away from us, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Canada was one of the ones they mandated vaccines, right?
Yeah, well, for all intents and purposes, the federal government does not have, much like in the U.S., they don't have exclusive authority over what happens in the provinces. The provinces here operate much like states,
right?
And they have their own jurisdictions over certain things. We operate along a federal system, but the difference in Canada is that the provinces are much more dependent upon the federal government for money. And, you know, so we really don't have a province in Canada that could operate, say, the way Florida did and just said the federal government, you know, talk to the hen, we're going to go our own way on COVID kind of thing.
Yeah.
But this concept of free speech and the preservation of it, you know, and its intersection with the way that social media is being used to suppress it, is something that I think might be the most important legal issue of our time.
Yes.
And there's another bill that's being passed in Canada right now, which is an online hate speech bill. And this anticipates the cooperation of social media in terms of being a reporter of free speech. And to just give you an example, I was watching a podcast the other day. And they already have laws like this in Great Britain. You're probably aware of this. But in 2018, over 3,300 people were arrested in Great Britain just for the things that they said online under these hate speech laws.
Yep.
And the social media is being used as a reporter. And one story really struck me. It was horrifying. This young lady, her friend had been killed. And she posted the lyrics of his favorite song online. Of course, it was a rap song. It was full of an N-word that we can't say on here. And she was arrested, charged, and convicted for hate speech.
Right.
And of course, I just mentioned this example because that type of cooperation between social media and government, which assists the government in using its exclusive authority, its exclusive it's monopoly on violence, on state-sanctioned violence, is something that's very scary, and it's part of what you're fighting in the U.S., isn't it?
It is, and that's just it. Is if we can knock them off their pedestal here, it'll have a trickle-down effect to other countries, right? They won't be able to quite keep up with situations like that because they won't be these mega companies that are protected and insulated by everything. And I'll give you a good example because, I mean, this is just another one of how important this is because people aren't grasping it. I don't think people understand. I think you just did, which is this is probably the most important thing out there. Everybody's talking about election integrity and the borders. you've got nothing if you got no free speech, period. You've got nothing. Mm-hmm. And the point is this. Let's just take it from the standpoint of vaccines. And I'm not even going to take a position as to whether they're good or bad. But the point is that if the government says they're good and me as an individual or you as an individual says they're bad, and then I get information from like Dr. Malone directly, who invented mRNA vaccines, and he's saying,
right,
no, this is really bad. And then there's evidence that says, wow, this is so bad, it's killing people. Wow, this is really – and all – I – well, now, if you don't know and I know, I want to tell you. How do I do that? Mm-hmm. You're not my neighbor. You're in a different country. How do I do that? I do that through the internet, and I do it through social media. But if the social media can control that conduit, I can't tell you it's bad. But all you see is that it's good. So you go and you get it, and you die.
It's a great
Cutting
example.
Off that speech, I mean, another one killed somebody, and that's the point
absolutely.
That we're. But we're facing that reality now. Mm-hmm. Well, people are sitting there and they're angry because they took all these vaccines, and now they're dealing with the consequences of those vaccines. And the point is, we can't even say "I told you so." I tried to tell you so, and I got cut off. Why? Mm-hmm. Because the government was working in collusion with big tech. And that's the problem. And the government's in collusion with the pharmaceutical companies. So we are literally lambs being led to slaughter, and we can't say anything about it because they're now shutting us up. That's dangerous.
Yeah, it is. And another big example for us is in Canada is that our government has sent over $10 billion to Ukraine. But we can't get any news on what's actually going on there. I don't know anyone who actually knows what's going on over there in that war. You hear different things that basically it's over. The Russians have won. We hear stories of people being killed, but then we have, you know, celebrities going over there and, you know, fly-in visits. I don't know what in the hee-haw is going on over in Ukraine, but I sure know that there's a heck of a lot of money going over there.
Can we tell you?
And yet we can't get any news. Yeah.
Can I just tell you what's going on?
If you know, I'd love to know. Tell me, because I don't have the sweetest clue what's going on.
Ukraine is the biggest CIA operation ever. That is what my understanding of it is. It is the CIA set up shop over there, and the reason being is they are sending money because that money is then being filtered to essentially invade America. A lot of that Ukraine money is going back down to like Ecuadorian countries, and they're paying. I mean, it just came out. What the Biden flew? What 310,000 people flew directly. They didn't even come across the border. They flew them in. Why? Because they're paying for it. That's how they're doing it. They're getting the money into Ukraine. Why? Because they've got to create voters in the United States. Because if the United States falls, the whole world falls. It's we're the only thing that's propping it up at the moment. And realistically, we're losing this battle. I mean, it's. I mean, you know, I'm 50 years old, right? I have been around long enough to think to myself, when I was a kid, I thought to myself, this would, I mean, nothing like this. I couldn't even imagine that my country would fall apart this bad, that there are people out there that want to destroy it, that have no problems destroying people's lives. And the worst part is that, you know, that's one thing, but then to not be able to tell people.
Yeah.
It's getting bad. And well, you know, what are we going to do? Go back to talking in the taverns? You know, that's how the Revolutionary War started.
Maybe that wouldn't be so bad.
It wouldn't, but you can't reach enough people. But as soon as they can organize, I mean, look at the devastating effects on government that these farmers have, right? Yeah. With all their tractors. Why? Because they've organized. They were able to organize. And once they can organize, man, they can really do. They're powerful, and that's the point here is that if you can keep everybody complacent, not let them know that, you know, and it's unfortunate because I think a lot of the, whatever you want to call us, right-leaning, conservative, however you want to denote it, those of us that are
freedom lovers,
just people that are intelligent, that remember the past and go, no, you're not going to tell me that that was wrong because I remember it. You know, the point is that I don't hate the left. I don't hate liberals. I feel sorry for them because they're delusional. They're deluded. They're being misled. And I want to give them the information. There's so many times that, you know, I've seen so many people and they're like, you know, just even take the Biden and Trump thing. Trump's horrible. Why? Give me one reason. And somebody says, well, Biden's horrible. Okay, give me one reason. I'll give you 100 reasons. Like, literally, he flew 300,000 people from a different country on my dime to come into my country to take my jobs, and they're not paying any taxes. I mean, I'll give you tons of reasons. And that's just it, is that they can't, if they can't get the information, we're doomed. Think about it. It already happened in school, right? Schools have stopped giving information.
Yeah. Speaking of Mr. Trump, do you think that if he's successful in regaining the presidency, that the damage that has been done by the Biden administration is reversible in the short term? Or do you think that we can't expect much of a sea change if Mr. Trump is restored to the White House? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we are – so when you start looking at it from my standpoint, you know, educated guy, I start looking at the – reading the tea leaves, as they say, right? Looking, you know, prospective. I think one of the biggest things that we're going to be dealing with very, very soon, I think this is going to happen – it's going to start happening now, is prior – if you recall the 2008 real estate bubble, right? The banks collapsed in America, and it was a small depression. The same thing is occurring right now. All of the same factors are there. Banks no longer – I think the Fed just said that they no longer have to have a 3% reserve. They have a 0% reserve. So these banks are fully hyperextended. And if there is a run on the banks, the American banking system is about to collapse. What does that mean? It is 10 times worse than 2008. They're predicting a bubble that is so big that it will make the Great Depression look like a joke. And people go, well, yeah, but we're in more modern times and we have welfare. Where's the welfare come from? It's borrowed debt, which means that all of this is just, we're robbing Peter to pay Paul until we can't pay it anymore. And then what happens is it's separating the classes, that there will only be the ultra elite and the poor. That's all that will be left. And it will be those that are the haves and the have nots. And that's what they want. I mean, they want to collapse it. Now, the point I'm saying that is that they're handing that to Trump now. So if they hand him an economy that's going to absolutely tank, right?
Yeah.
No, Trump brought back the economy last time. They said, oh, well, that was from Obama. And then they said, well, then Biden collapsed the economy now. And it's like, oh, no, that Trump did that. And it's like, okay, so when the government really collapsed, they'll say, well, no, it was Trump coming back in again, which is like, it's always however they decide to spin it. And the reason being is because people don't remember. They're like goldfish, right? They like remember 7 minutes back, and that's about it. And unfortunately, I think that's what we're going to – I mean, Trump has got a huge hurdle. As they're saying, it's got to be bigger than they can rig it, right? That's the point, is they have to be able to beat the cheat here. That's the only way he can come in. And, I mean, they've tried everything, and it doesn't work. I mean, because I think that even the people that – and that, again, comes back to information, granted, gotten through social media. People have caught on. They've seen it. They've understood it. And when they see their peers, because nobody trusts the government. Nobody trusts schools. Nobody trusts any. What you tend to trust, human beings, trust their peers, right? I trust my mom, my dad, my brother, my sisters. Some people don't. But the point is, you trust your friends. And when you see your friends saying things that are – that go against the cognitive dissonance, right? What you believe, I can't, no, you're but when you see a friend doing it, it breaks through. But if you can't see your friend saying that stuff, and that's how groupthink starts. That's what social media controls. That if we can push back against that, we can go, no, I mean, Biden's not even functioning. I mean, it's amazing
how he's really deteriorated.
The news is just propping him up. Like, I mean, it's like Weekend at Bernie's, you know? Yeah. The guy's been dead, and he just didn't even know.
Although I have to say, I'd still say that an even chess match between he and Justin Trudeau is a toss-up. But be that as it may, this has been an edifying hour with you, Jason. Just learned so much. Very exciting what's going on in the United States. And, you know, you're so courageous what you're doing. And it impacts not just people in the United States. It's important for people who are watching this and listening, understand that this is the key fight going on right now for freedom of speech in the world, because if this gets changed in the United States, it's going to have a ripple effect around the world. Yep. And so, Jason, God bless you and the work that you're doing. And thank you for taking this time to share this with us. We end off our show with something called a reading list. And I get the sense that you're a man who's well-read, could think of many books. But the idea is to share with us maybe one or two, not just necessarily books, but maybe websites or something like that, that would further people's understanding of our discussion and the work that you're doing. I've got two books, and then I'm going to hand it over to you and give you the last word. These two books are both written by somebody named Jason Fick. The first one is called Mags to Riches. This is a book that you wrote about 10 years ago. Do you want to talk about this book a little bit, why you wrote it?
Well, actually, Mags to Riches, I took off. That was a ghostwriter, and I was not impressed with it once it came off. But I rewrote it, and ironically, it's sitting right behind me. I think is the second book you're going to be talking about.
Yeah, which it's is a book Social Justice from Jail to Social Media. I'm working my way through it right now.
It's
very fascinating. Social justice is a concept that I struggle with because I think it's an oxymoron, accent on the moron. But yeah. So let's hear it from you, kind of why you wrote the book and what your inspiration was and what you were trying to achieve with the book.
So obviously the title is a wordplay. The reason being is because I use social media to get justice. So my story actually starts, like we said, back in 2010, and the reason I started building a massive audience, some people would be surprised to learn how it is, and that's what this book is about. The story basically is that I had started a magazine, online magazine, started out with Facebook, and the first interview that I ever got was in Baltimore City, Maryland, which is a pretty corrupt city. And at the end of the night of that interview, I was asked if I would drive some of the people home. I only knew one person, like maybe 3 or 4 hours, and I hadn't been drinking. So I said, sure, I could drop them home. And there was like five of them. And when we went to the parking garage to get to my car, some other people came out and they had been drinking. And of course the crowd that I was with, they had been drinking. And what started out as a friendly sort of goofy back and forth turned into an argument, which then turned into a fight. Now, what I did from that point forward was very simple. I pulled out my cell phone. And I recorded a small fight. It was a minute and a half long. Nobody was seriously hurt. Nobody was, the worst injury was a possible broken nose. Possible. The people that were involved in the fight, they didn't even go to the hospital till the next day. And I got in my car. And at that point, I didn't even want to stay around these guys. I dropped them off and I went home. About a month later, I get police show up at my house and they seize my vehicle as evidence. And whole thing. Now, what I did was a First Amendment protected right. I was in a public space. I wasn't involved in the fight. Nobody was seriously harmed. I should have been protected by the First Amendment, but I wasn't. About 2 months afterwards, I get a call and told that I have a warrant for my arrest for taking a cell phone video. Now, this is where it gets really strange, Leighton. Do you know what I was charged with? Which you've been reading the book, so I'm sure you may be at that point.
Yeah.
I was charged with conspiracy to commit first-degree attempted murder.
Wow.
Nobody was seriously harmed. In a fight I wasn't even in, for taking a cell phone video, which is constitutionally protected. It was absurd. I mean, it was absolutely bizarre. Well, it turned out the people that were all involved in the fight had family that were cops. So they abused the judicial system against me. And not only that, but here I am. I had never been arrested in my life. I went to private school. I have no arrest record. I'm like the model citizen. I have property. I have a family. And I'm denied bail for taking a cell phone video. So I spent the next...
This is like the plot of a movie starring Harrison Ford.
It's absolutely bizarre. I spent the next 2 months in jail in one of the worst... I mean, it was literally rated the second worst jail in the entire nation. It has since been shut down. They closed it because it was so corrupt. And the interesting thing was that it taught me something. That's what put the bug in me to go after government. I can't stand the abuse of the judicial system. I respect it wholly. It's just like police, love them to death unless they're corrupt. And then no, they are worse than criminals. They're criminals with authority. And that's the way I look at the government now is that you have authority to be a criminal. No, I'll fight against that. And see, that's where social media came in.
Yeah.
I needed to tell my story. I needed to get the information out there. And people would probably recall, and this is where the book takes us, is it brings it all the way back to the police corruption trend of 2015. I had so much influence at the time. I could change national trends. And I was the one who created that national trend by projecting forward. Well, that's exactly what Big Tick does today. They pick a topic that they want to recommend or prioritize or facilitate, and they use their control. I used mine back then, but it was a fair fight back then. And it changed the world.
But you were vindicated, though, weren't you?
Yeah, ironically, by the time I managed to get to an actual court, by the time I remember, and this all ended, that I was sitting in – I was supposed to get a continuance that day because my attorney was in a capital murder trial, so he couldn't be there. And, of course, I have to have representation. So I was there, but I was going to get a continuance. And instead, the judge, she called Jason Fick, and I stood up and I said, you know, I'm here. And she turned to the prosecutor and said, can you approach the bench? And they approached the bench. And I could hear her say to the prosecutor, right? So this is to the state's attorney of Maryland. What did he do wrong? I've spent 2 months in jail. And the judge can't even identify what I did that was illegal because it was constitutionally protected. And yet they wrecked my life doing it. So long and the short of it is the prosecutor was told to null pros, which is basically drop the charges. And they dropped the charges and I was dismissed right there on the spot with a court apology. Sorry to take your time, Mr. Fick. And off I went. I got a good judge. And that's what it comes down to these days.
Yeah. Well, you've written a third book, though, haven't you, called Jason's American Dream, right?
Well, here's –
have you published that one yet?
Here's the problem. I had a second book that I have not actually made public because I hadn't been able to the time to finish it. And then I got into the war with Facebook. And unfortunately, although I have a series for three because there's enough of a story here because, of course, it transpires into this whole mess now. I'm working on it. Just the time is difficult to get it all done, but eventually I will have a trilogy of this whole thing because this story really is absurd. You know what?
Yeah.
The interactions I've had with government, it's just like, what happened to the judicial system? What happened to law?
Yeah.
You know, what happened to the constitutional republic? I have never seen, other than that judge that dismissed me that day, and actually the one that gave me the original bail hearing, I've never really had a judge do anything for me. They've always worked against us. And it's like, why? Yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. But then again, I've always fought David versus Goliath fights.
Yep. That's it. You got to find some five smooth, small stones.
Yep.
Looks like you're very close to hitting the mark with them.
We hope.
So back to you. Are there any other books that you would recommend or sources of information you'd recommend to people? I know you mentioned those law cases. Would you have any other recommendations for our viewers and listeners so they get a better understanding of the fight that you're in and the work that you're doing?
Well, I would absolutely recommend going to socialmediafreedom.org. There is a lot of information on there because, of course, this has dominated my life and we put a lot of, information together. Obviously, there's lots of case law, which, of course, I mean, even our Supreme Court petitions are technically books. You actually have to print and publish books. They're behind me as well. But as far as pleasure reading, I don't really have the time to do it. So I don't have anything on the forefront of what I'm doing at the moment. But I will say that for any attorneys out there that may have watched this, I would say that the cases that you need to pay attention to that are is roommates versus public – was it fair housing – look at Henderson versus Public Data. There's a Rumble versus Google. Dangard versus Instagram is literally the holy grail. So if as far as I'm concerned, I don't care because somebody asked me, they're like, well, what if somebody else beats it? I don't care about a fame. I don't care about credit. I just want to stop them. Like,
right.
As far as I'm concerned, I just somebody, anybody. I mean, Dangard, essentially got ahead of us. Why? Because that judge did it right. Like he took due care and protected them. And I'm very impressed. I mean, I if we had gotten Judge Alsop, I don't think I'd be in this position. I would have long since been to court. But instead, we've had to tackle the entire law and gotten proficient at it. So, materials wise, that's what I would recommend. Obviously, the websites and I don't know what platforms you're on, but get on Twitter. The information is so much more widespread on Twitter. It's useless to be on Facebook or Google or YouTube or anything anymore to really find good information.
Yeah. Well, Jason, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you and learning more about you. And, you know, God bless your fight. You're fighting on behalf of a lot of people, not only in your own country, but also in Canada, and for everyone who cherishes free speech around the world and wants to have free access to a public forum where we can express ourselves freely without concern about censorship or suppression or arrest or coercion by government and big tech, really should be interested in the fight that you're waging right now. And I'm so pleased that we were able to talk with you and showcase it on our program today. So thanks for being our special guest today on Grey Matter.
Thank you for having me, Layton.
My pleasure.